Okay, I want to say a couple of things. I'm going to make, I think, a bold statement for those of you who are not believers. I think that the evidence from science, the evidence from philosophy, at this point in time, is stronger for a creator, specifically the creator of the Bible, than it is for any natural random processes creating things. There's a book out. Somebody loaned it to me. I've been reading it, and I think the title of this book says what I'm just saying. It's called, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. And I think that's the state of things now. I think it takes more faith to be an atheist than it does to be a believer. So if you disagree with that, you're welcome to ask questions. If you agree with that, you can ask questions, make a comment. That's what that microphone's for. Now, there's a couple of rules. You're welcome to ask as many questions as you like, but if there are people behind you in line, please go to the end of the line after you've asked your first question. And the questions are not like 15-part questions, please. Just one normal question, and then go to the end of the line and ask another question. But we really want to encourage you to ask tough questions. We don't want easy questions. We don't want soft questions. We want the questions, maybe the questions that you've really been struggling with your whole life, the questions that have kept you from a relationship with God or even believing in God, those are the challenges that we want. And many people who are believers have issues that they struggle with that keep them from a deep relationship with God. Those are the kind of questions we want. We don't want politically correct questions this morning. Sponsor of this event is the Paradox Sunday School class here at Sierra Madre Congregational Church. We meet at 11 o'clock every Sunday morning right in this building next door in room 154. We call it 154 because that's the street address. It's a storefront. We try to do these skeptics forums about 3 or 4 times a year, but Paradox class happens every Sunday. So if you enjoy this, please feel welcome to come to Paradox. It's a lot of fun. And then we're also going to do this again tomorrow night. So if you can't get enough of this, you have people that want to come that you think would enjoy this, tomorrow night won't be here. It will be in 154 again next door tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. If you are shy to go to the microphone but you have a burning question, there is a man here named Dave. Dave, raise your hand. Where's Dave? Dave's over here. Thank you, Dave. Dave, write your question on a piece of paper, hand it to Dave. Dave will be happy to go to the microphone for you in your stead. Thank you, Dave. Our speaker this morning, as always, is Dr. Hugh Ross. I want to introduce Dr. Hugh Ross. He's the founder and president of Reasons to Believe. It's a Christian think tank where he does wrestle with these kinds of ideas. Science, faith, how can science support the God of the Bible, and those kinds of things. He's the author of about 14 books. Dr. Ross has a PhD in astronomy from the University of Toronto. He has a BA in physics from the University of British Columbia. And I'd like you all to welcome Dr. Hugh Ross.
Thank you. All right. It's a little bit different today in that I'm usually here all by myself. And you're wondering, why do we have two other people here? Well, there's two reasons. The first reason is that, I'm on the autistic spectrum. And being on the autistic spectrum, I have the gift of being able to integrate things, which helps me do what I do. But there's also certain defects. I can't read people's emotions, at least not quickly. And sometimes it's hard for me to hear the actual questions that people are asking. So these two individuals from the Los Angeles Reasons to Believe chapter, part of their role is to help me understand more accurately the questions that you're asking.
We'll translate.
Right. And it's not that I can't, it's just that there's a very long time lag, and sometimes it takes me time. But there's another reason. I'm not an expert in everything, and for example, we have Mark Perez at the end here. He has a master's in the philosophy of science from Cal State University. And as a trained philosopher, he'll be equipped to handle the philosophical questions. And then we have our moderator here, Ross Hoagland, and he's also with the Los Angeles chapter, and he's the one that does all the coordination for these skeptics forums. But there's a second reason we're doing this. It is our goal at Reasons to Believe that we would see these skeptics forums multiplied across the country. And I get people saying, "Hugh, I can't do what you do." And I say, "Well, you don't have to do it alone." And frequently I'll do this skeptics forum where we actually have our entire science and philosophy team from our Reasons to Believe staff. So it'll be four of us up here. And again, we do that to make it clear that, all right, we're not expert in everything, but if we have a panel, we're more likely to cover the bases. So if you're sitting there saying, "You know, I've been a Christian for a number of years. I've studied the book of nature and the book of scripture. I'd like to do this." Find a couple of other people to do it with you, and we'll help you get it launched. Because we'd like to see several of these over the Los Angeles basin and around the country. So that's why you're seeing a little different format here. And let us know what you think of that format. So with that, the rule here is, I'll keep talking about new discoveries that give us more evidence for the God of the Bible until somebody shows up at that microphone. As soon as somebody shows up, I quit talking. And by the way, if there's nobody at the microphone, well, I've got several discoveries we can talk about from the latest scientific literature.
Somebody beat you to it.
Somebody beat me to it?
Not quite.
Not quite. All right. Well, one thing we can thank God for, this is published in Brain and Behavioral Sciences, several articles on rats. And as I read this stuff, it just kind of made me thrilled, thinking, wow, we can really thank God for the way God designed rats. And the interesting thing about rats is, of all the mammals that we see on the planet, they're the only ones, along with mice, that have the identical chemical pathways that govern memory as we human beings do. And so it's through research on mice, and rats are actually better, where we're able to get developing cures for the breakdown in the chemical pathways that govern memory for human beings. Say, what's that all about? I'm talking about dementia, Alzheimer's, dyslexia. Those are human maladies where there's a breakdown or a dysfunction in the chemical pathways that govern memory. And I've just been thrilled in reading these papers. Number one, experiments are being done to show that there are certain drugs we can give to rats when they're middle-aged. You say, what's a middle-aged rat? About 6 months old. You know, for us, it's 50. For them, it's 6 months. And they're giving these drugs to these middle-aged rats, and when they discover that when they become aged, what's an aged rat? A rat that's more than 12 months old. So that'd be equivalent to somebody who's in their, quote, retirement years. And what they're discovering is that the level of brain function that governs memory pathways is far better for those who've been treated since the time that they were 6 months old up to the time they're 12 months old, and they actually get a significantly less incidence of mouse and rat dementia. And so the next step, of course, is to see if this will work with human beings. And then there's another paper here that's been published that makes the point that, all right, what about rats that are aged and are already suffering from dementia? Well, once again, they're finding drugs that are able to restore memory to rats that have lost memory. So once again, the whole idea is how this will translate to human beings. But the very fact that rats are unique compared to human beings, and that they're the only species that of life on the planet that has identical chemical pathways that govern memory, means that this is going to be the most fruitful arena for developing cures for what ails us. And you know, it's just, why are we so interested today? We're living longer. For the first time, human beings are living long enough where this has become a serious problem. You know, I remember seeing a billboard in Japan that most of the people who lived past the age of 65 from Adam and Eve forward are alive today. People are living longer than they ever have before. And that's why we're seeing such an incidence of these memory maladies. but now we can do these experiments on rats and develop potential cures. And it's exciting. So it looks like we're already well on the way towards those cures. But the evolutionists will tell you that our closest relative in terms of the function of our mind would be the chimpanzees and the orangutans. But it turns out it's mice and rats, not the orangutans and chimpanzees in terms of how our memory works. And what better animal for doing these kinds of experiments than mice and rats? So I write about in my books how God gave us rodents to help us develop clothing at the launch of human civilization. And now that we're in a high-tech civilization context, it's like God had to design rats in advance to help us develop the medical advances that we need. I thought by now somebody would be behind the microphone. Oh, actually, somebody is coming up behind the microphone. So I'll save the astrophysical stuff until later. All right, go ahead.
Yes, Dr. Ross. I'm a senior at Cal State Los Angeles. I'm a history major, and I wanted to ask you about two statements that Albert Einstein, I think, maybe made. I was talking to one of your assistants, your elders and stuff, and he recognized the first one, is that Albert Einstein, we think, said, God did not play dice with the universe in regards to this the Big Bang theory. And he wouldn't use the name God if he didn't believe in a God. But did he say that first statement that I just said? Is that true?
Well, this is in writing, and you'll see it documented in my book, The Fingerprint of God, that Einstein said that he believed in the God of Spinoza. Not the God of Christianity, but the God of Spinoza. And the God of Spinoza is a deistic being. In other words, God creates a universe, sets up the laws of physics, but then allows his physical laws to produce everything else thereafter. So he would be denying that God is personally interested in the affairs of human beings. And the quote about the dice came out of a conversation he had with the physicist Niels Bohr. You know, Niels Bohr is recognized as the father of quantum mechanics, and Albert Einstein is the father of relativity. And so they were having this debate. And Niels Bohr was saying, in quantum mechanics, we see all of these probabilistic phenomena that looks like God is playing with dice. And Einstein said, no, God determines everything. Everything is determined. God does not play with dice. That debate, 50 years later, was resolved when people in studying quantum mechanics recognized, yes, there's built-in uncertainty, improbability, if you prefer, in quantum mechanics. That's what's the core of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. There's a built-in uncertainty. However, that uncertainty must be highly fine-tuned in order for life molecules to operate. So, for example, in your human body, you'll find all kinds of molecules that act like transistors. And being transistors, it's crucial that they be able to govern quantum tunneling. And the quantum tunneling is predicated on there being an uncertainty at the quantum level. And so, for example, if we were to choose to measure the energy level of a quantum particle, the uncertainty in its position would be about plus or minus half a mile. So the uncertainty is large, but if we're any bigger or any smaller, these transistor molecules in our bodies would not be able to function, and we would all die. And so God does play with dice, but he very carefully designs the dice to get exactly the results that he wants. So in that sense, both Bohr and Einstein were right.
Thank you. Hi. I can't confess to being a skeptic. I'm an ardent believer. Nevertheless, the recent WMAP data that came out showed that the universe is not homogeneous and not isotropic. And as I understand it, most of the standard, say, Friedman universes or things related to Friedman universes are predicated upon the assumption of a homogeneous isotropic universe.
So prior to WMAP coming out, everybody could sort of wave their hands and say, well, homogeneous isotropic is a good assumption. What they really mean by that, of course, is that you can solve the equations when you have that. But my question is, given that the experimental data is now saying universe is not homogeneous, not isotropic, when you propagate WMAP backwards in time, where those inhomogeneities become more and more and more important, what does that do to a hot Big Bang model? And through all of the different possible directions in the non-homogeneous, non-isotropic universe, what does that do to timelines that you would follow as you would go through them all?
Okay, good question. And, back in the 1980s, when we looked at the cosmic background radiation, the radiation from the cosmic creation event, it did indeed measure to be perfectly homogeneous and isotropic to the best level of our measurements.
Can you explain, Hugh, to everyone else what those two terms mean?
Yeah. What isotropy and homogeneity mean is that everywhere you look, it looks the same. And so there's no difference to what you see from one position in the sky and the other. And there's no distinctives in the makeup of the universe. So it'd be perfectly smooth, it'd be the uniform thing, and the homogeneity would mean it would have the same components everywhere you look. And indeed, back in the 1980s, that's exactly what the measurements of the radiation from the cosmic creation event told us. But back then, astronomers were very concerned that it would continue to measure perfectly homogeneous and uniform. They said, if the Big Bang model is right, there's got to be some level of inhomogeneity and non-uniformity, because if it's perfectly smooth and perfectly homogeneous, you'd never get galaxies, stars, or planets. The universe would be nothing but dispersed mass or dispersed gas. And clearly we don't live in a universe that's 100% gas. We actually do see some clumping in the universe. And so the COBE satellite was the first time they actually were able to detect the slight departure from non-uniformity and non-homogeneity. However, it was not accurate enough to see if the non-uniformity and non-homogeneity was consistent with the maps we have of clusters of galaxies and individual galaxies. The WMAP satellite was put up to actually take us to that level. And the timing of the WMAP was consistent with the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. The Sloan Digital Sky Survey was a massive project still ongoing to map in detail the distribution of galaxies and galaxy clusters and voids throughout the universe. And the goal was to match the Sloan Digital Sky Survey maps with the WMAP to see if they got a good fit between the small levels of inhomogeneity and what we saw in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. And that's probably been one of the most dramatic demonstrations that the hot Big Bang creation model indeed is correct, because they do see a perfect match between the Sloan Digital Sky Survey inhomogeneities and the inhomogeneities they see in the WMAP. Now, to give you the reason why astronomers still claim that the universe is homogeneous and uniform, it is homogeneous and uniform to within one part in 10,000. But it can't be homogeneous to one part in a million. If it's homogeneous to one part in a million, we can't explain the galaxies and clusters of galaxies. And so, if you're interested, you'll see some articles I've written on our website at reasons.org under Today's New Reason to Believe, where we talk about the very latest measurements of giant voids and groupings of clusters of galaxies and how that fits with competing hot Big Bang creation models. Because today we actually have many different hot Big Bang creation models that compete with one another. But what you'll see in those results is the inhomogeneities and non-uniformities we measure are best fitting what's called the Lambda CDM Hot Big Bang Creation Model. That I'll unpackage that for you. That's a model of the universe that's dominated by dark energy, where the matter is dominated by exotic dark matter, matter where it's made up of particles that don't strongly interact with light. And where those exotic dark matter particles are moving predominantly at low velocities relative to the velocity of light.
But as I understand it, the Lambda CDM model and many of the standard models are still based on widely homogeneous isotropic assumptions. And my question is, when you propagate this lumpiness that we've measured backwards in time, at some point, homogeneity and isotropy fails as an assumption, right? And so as you propagate that lumpiness backwards in time, you're going to get all sorts of crazy timeline paths through it all.
You're right.
When
you
does
will.
That become a dominant effect, and how much does that affect the overall model?
Well, this is something that's tied into the inflationary event. And so right now, we astronomers are trying to nail down exactly what is the character of inflation. And the inflation event is when the universe is about 10 to the minus 34 seconds old. And this is where it hyperinflates, expands at a rate many, many times the velocity of light as a result of the strong nuclear force being separated out from the electroweak force. So you get a symmetry breaking that results in several anomalous behaviors. And, you know, when I say anomalous, it's kind of like what happens when you go from water vapor to liquid water at 212 degrees. There's a phase transition which leads to some anomalous behavior in the water molecule. Well, this is similar to the universe as a whole when you get the single force separating the two forces of physics, and then three, and then four. So when it separates into the three forces of physics is when you get this inflation event. And the WMAP already told us that it must be inflation. So that doubt's been removed. We know there's an inflation that's governing what happens to the inhomogeneity and non-uniformity. But now the goal is to find out exactly what kind of inflation we're dealing with. And WMAP has given us a hint that it's complex inflation, not simple inflation, which means there's going to be at least two constants of physics that are governing that inflation, or maybe to put it another way, maybe there's more than one inflaton. We're now looking at fundamental particles that actually factor in to the inflation event. And I think within the next 2 or 3 years, we're going to nail that down. Number one, because we've got the Planck satellite collecting much more definitive data on the cosmic background radiation. And then secondarily in astronomy, we're on the verge of discovering sterile neutrinos and axions. And axions in particular may prove to be the result of the decay of inflatons that occurred during the inflation era. So if you come back to the microphone in 2 or 3 years, we may be able to give you a definitive answer to your question. But right now, it's I don't know.
Okay, I'll see you in 2 years.
All right. So, Hugh, before we get another question, can you explain why what you just said is important to the Christian faith? How does it reflect a creator?
Well, it reflects a creator in that the more we learn about the cosmic background radiation and the history of the universe and its measure of uniformity and homogeneity, we're seeing increasing evidence for fine-tuning design that makes human beings possible. You know, when we first started studying this, we felt inflation wasn't necessary. We now realize that we don't have inflation. You can't have the galaxies and stars and planets showing up at the right time in cosmic history with the right level of homogeneity, because that's what inflation guarantees, that you're going to get a high degree of homogeneity and uniformity. And the rate at which it inflates will determine whether or not you get the planets showing up at the right time in cosmic history in the right place to make human life possible. Which means that when you celebrate Thanksgiving in November, you might want to thank God for the inflationary cosmic era and the inflatons that make it possible for you to enjoy your Thanksgiving dinner.
Hugh, your next book should be all the things we should be grateful for Thanksgiving. You've got quite a list.
Well, that list actually is near infinity, I think, so. Go ahead.
So, could you comment on the significance of Genesis 1's account of God speaking everything into existence as related to our understanding of the fundamental motion of particles and particularly like string theory, which in essence states that everything is made up of packets of vibrating strings.
Wow. First of all, I would caution not to read too much into Genesis 1. And it reasons to believe we get manuscripts, at least on a weekly basis, where people think that Genesis 1 is talking about things like positrons, neutrons, protons, and details about the cosmic creation event. It is true that it tells us that the universe was created by a transcendent being, that there was a space-time beginning. So space and time, according to the Bible, didn't exist until God created the universe. And yes, you won't see it in Genesis 1 so much, but particularly the prophet Isaiah talks about how God speaks things into existence. However, there's a lot of debate amongst theologians. What does it mean for God to speak something into existence? And I think a much more fascinating question, what does it mean for God to speak things out of existence? Because there will come a time when God will speak the whole universe out of existence. And so how do we understand that? Well, maybe if we get a better understanding of the beginning of the universe, that will give us some insight into how the universe will end and what it means for God to speak and things happen. So does that mean the spirit within every human being was spoken into existence? If that's so, because God claims that when he creates a human being, at the moment of conception, he creates the spirit within the human being. It's God speaking that into existence. But I think you're insightful, because what you see in Genesis 1 is God consistently commenting, it was good, it was good, it was good. So he's definitely talking. But what does all that mean? Other than the fact that we would expect to find optimized fine-tuning in everything we investigate in the creation. And that is something a scientist can pursue. To look at the record of nature and see, do we see low-level design, or is it high-level design? Is it optimized? And is it optimized for many different purposes, or just a few purposes? I look at all of that as the handiwork of God. So, for example, when I look at the physics of the universe, I can see at least 12 different reasons for why God designed it the way he did. And there's optimization in each of those different reasons. So, but maybe you've got something else. Maybe this is where you guys can help me out. I mean, exactly what kind of question are you trying to pursue?
Sure. So, so I guess a relevant question would be, do you think that one can see in science, like, the significance of what it means for God to speak things into existence as an underlying principle of physics?
Let me put it this way. It does say it's good, and Genesis 1 ends with it's very good, which means that I, as a scientist, as I check out the design of the universe, I should expect that it measures really good. So, for example, 50 years ago, medical scientists were claiming that the human body was filled with crippled and badly designed organs. Well, that would contradict what the Bible is claiming. The Bible is claiming that when he created us, it was very good. And so what we've seen in the last 50 years is that the original presumption that the appendix, for example, served no function. It was just a useless organ that was a hangover from our evolution from animals. And now we realize that the appendix indeed serves no function for digestion, but plays a critical role in the human immune response system. And so medical doctors no longer routinely remove the appendix when they do abdominal surgery. And today, medical science has advanced where we realize all these different organs that we thought were useless actually are very good examples of optimal design, including the human backbone. It is true that the human backbone is not optimized for running. It's not optimized for lying down. It's not optimized for sitting or walking, but it's optimized to do all four. There's no better design of the human backbone that allows you to sit for 8 hours in front of a computer at the same time allows you to run a marathon.
I want to say something on that. I think that maybe what you're asking is about the word speaking.
Right.
God obviously is a spirit being. There was no physical reality at that point. So I think it's a metaphor for him intentionally willing something into existence or something to happen, and that's the metaphor that we would all understand when we say God speaks it into existence. It means he's doing something on purpose, willfully, whatever that means to him.
Yeah, God doesn't have a voice box. So
I want to ask Mark a question. From a Christian standpoint, Mark, what does it mean, do you think, that there is a beginning to all physical reality in the first place? How does that, why should we care about that?
Well, if there is a beginning to all physical reality, then there had to have been something that created it. And from a philosophical viewpoint, when you get to the end of the scientific inquiry, you start the metaphysical inquiry. And a lot of people don't like to use the term metaphysics, but metaphysics is merely the study of things that go beyond the physical. And that could include Christianity. Now, Christianity isn't entirely metaphysical. I don't want to go there. But to the point of your question, if we understand that scientists can answer the questions up to a certain point and then realize beyond that it is no longer a scientific question, it becomes either philosophical or becomes spiritual, and we as Christians get to engage that, and that we do not have to recoil at the thought that there are scientists who want to say that there's nothing before what we have now, or there's a multiverse or some other kind of theory. And what we should be doing is asking, on what basis will you assume some other model? If you're not going to assume the Christian model, on what basis will you assume a non-Christian model? And that's an honest question we need to be posing. And it's a question that we have as Christians as much evidence or more evidence than anybody else does for competing models. So I think the bottom line, Ross, is that when we look at all of this evidence for the universe being originated in one point, and whether it's spoken into being or whatever that means, there is some room there for us to negotiate and to talk with people who aren't Christians, to let them see the other viewpoints, particularly the Christian viewpoint, so that they'll realize they're not stuck.
So are you saying then that science is not the ultimate answer, that there is, the science is actually based on philosophical assumptions?
Well, there are, absolutely there are philosophical assumptions in science.
So science can't prove itself?
No, it can't. But we have to be careful what we mean by when we talk about science. Science can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And if you were to go to a book on the philosophy of science and look up the question, demarcation, what separates science from non-science, you're going to find a whole lot of reading and literature to do about that. And so what we have to be careful of is to realize that, number one, if we look at science as a social enterprise, of a group of people who are trying to research the universe and understand the phenomena and the forces at work, then science is neutral. It's not good or bad or indifferent. But if we look at science as a practice, then there are different ways of looking at it, different procedures. For example, there's one notion of appreciating how science is done in that, I just went blank on the name, the methodological naturalism. That's where I was going. I apologize. I have a cold, and it's slowing me down. Methodological naturalism can be looked at two ways. There's capital M, capital N, methodological naturalism, and that is a philosophical presumption. That is, that I presume that the only things I can ever discover with science are only things that can answer physical problems. And then there's philosophical naturalism, or philosophical naturalism with small letters to begin with. And that's just the practice of assuming that whatever scientific investigation you're going to do, that there will be a natural cause. Assuming it, not presuming it. Because there does come a point at which when you look at multiple models, if one explains much more than the other one does, And one explanation is that the reason you're running into gaps is that there really is no physical explanation. Then you have to look for a non-physical explanation. So, in other words, philosophical naturalism as a procedure is very effective because it will push you to the point where you recognize we have to go outside of physics for the answer. Is that responsive to your question?
Yes, thank you. Next question, Ted.
Yes, my question deals with near death or returning from death, those type of situations. For instance, there have been incidents where a person will come back with information they had no possibility of knowing prior to their accident or illness. And the illnesses in many cases are such to where they're cold and no brain waves, no heartbeat, nothing. And 3-4 days later, they come out of the cold box in the morgue, and gee, this guy wasn't dead. What happened there? And they'll come back with a story with information that they had no means of getting. And then there are other cases to where it's not that severe. The guy was in a coma, and they come out of their coma with another a group of information. And another category would be it's a fantastic thing. Another category would be where a person comes out of a coma with no story at all, just, gee, what's happening here? And there's no story. So clearly the most mystifying to me are the ones where people give you information that they didn't have and had no access to. Information about events occurring miles away with people, possible family members, discussions going on, detailed information. And generally it has to be a traumatic deal, a bad car accident, an illness to death, that kind of a deal. I have a story to relate about my mother. I'll make it quick. She was 9 years old, got in the 30s, got too much nitrous oxide in the dentist's office, went off. She saw her deceased neighbor who had died before she was born of cancer. And the lady introduced her children to my mother. She came to and she had a big circle of faces around her, everyone terrified, including my grandma and the doctor, the nurses, everybody. They gave her an adult dose of the gas. So anyway, she revived. And well, you know, Ma, I saw, you know, Mrs. Garbedian. She showed me her children. She told me about her cancer. And this is her children's names. And they're both with her. And she looked great. So my grandma, who's dark like me, turned white from terror. So my mom never met Mrs. Garbedian or her kids. So that's just one event. So I'll let that go. You people tell me
now. Sure, go ahead.
Ted, I want to try that one.
Okay.
I've actually done a lot of reading about this, and that's one thing I'm kind of passionate about. One of the things that naturalists will say is that science can only deal with things that have a natural cause. And I think this is a really excellent refutation of that. Science is as much about the process as it is about the cause. What would happen if we used the scientific process and in using that process to look at a particular phenomenon, we come to the conclusion that that phenomenon is supernatural? And I think this is a really good example because there are now hundreds and thousands of events in peer-reviewed literature in the medical profession where people who are on an operating table have what's called a near-death experience, and it's not just that they see things. They see lights or they see God or they see loved ones, things that you can't test. But they see things that they could not have seen even if they were awake sitting up on the operating table. And they see these things that relate to reality. And in many cases, they don't have enough activity, brain waves and heartbeat, to even have been awake if they were. There's a really good example. This woman went into cardiac arrest. She was on the operating table. She claims that she floated out of her body. She up on the roof of the hospital. There was a tennis shoe that somebody had thrown up there. She claimed to have seen this. And when she came back, she was revived. She came back. She told somebody in the hospital about this tennis shoe. And they went up on the roof and there it was exactly as she had described it. Now, it seems to me that all you have to do is show that that actually happened one time, and that's evidence that we are not purely physical, that there's a spiritual side to us. The fact is, it's happened hundreds again and thousands of times. That's more and more documentation of this, where people are seeing things. They're looking at gauges on the equipment, you know, that is keeping them alive while they're on the operating table. They notice that the surgeon has funny colored socks or something that they could not have seen. Now, it seems to me that this is a real physical evidence that there is a spiritual side to us. And here's another thing that you can extrapolate from that is, not only do they see these things, they come back and they can relate these things that actually relate to reality, but they remember them. Now, what does that say about where our memory is? Our memory is not entirely in our physical body. If they can leave their body, go up and see something that's actually there, which is the proof that it's not a dream, they come back and they remember it, it means some of our memory has to be in our spiritual side, not just our physical side. I think this is an excellent, excellent line of inquiry that shows that we really do have a spiritual side, that it's not all material.
Yeah, and Ted, if you want to hear an expert's response to this, Dr. Fazran and I interviewed a Dr. Sabota on this, a medical doctor who's done a lot of experimental research on this. And what we appreciated about him is he was very conservative about this, making it clear that over 90% of individuals who claim to have a near-death experience really don't. But there's a small residual where you got data, like Ross here is talking about, which makes it clear that something was happening that's beyond what can be explained by mere physical matter. And so it's a small percentage, and when people come to me with a near-death experience, I'm always very skeptical. After all, we know that if you deprive the brain of oxygen, you will see a bright light. That will happen. And so when people say, I saw a bright light, well, hey, you know, that's ordinary, and you will hallucinate. So we ask them questions about what their hallucination was all about. But there are many examples, as Ross has pointed out, where you got specific information that's consistent with what's real that obviously the patient who went through this experience couldn't possibly have discerned if they had remained, quote, within their body, or if it was just purely physics. Anyways, about a two-hour interview we had with this Dr. Sabota is up on our website as a podcast, and you can listen to it.
How do you spell the guy's name?
Gee, I don't know.
Is it S-U-V?
But it's the only interview we've done on near-death experiences on our website. So if you just put that into our search engine, it should pop right up. The interview took place about 5 years ago.
Thank you.
Okay.
Hugh, on that interview, excuse me, did the physician describe events where the people remembered things that weren't associated to them? For example, we have, you know, this one where they had the shoe on the top of the roof and people seeing things like, well, I saw my grandmother's relatives or whatever. But I haven't heard anybody talk about things that happened in another country or someplace on another part of the planet. And it seems like these events somehow are localized.
Well, Dr. Sabota, he would immediately eliminate any descriptions of people that were familiar with these individuals.
Okay.
Because they figure, hey, relatives, somebody might have given that little child information about the grandmother that the mother knows nothing about.
Right.
And so he said, you know, he immediately just took those off the table as examples of legitimate near-death experiences. Go ahead.
In the reading that I've done, Mark, it seems like people, when they're in these near-death experiences, they don't just appear somewhere and then appear somewhere else. They're actually moving to that place and then moving back. So maybe it is localized somehow.
I don't either. I was kind of hoping maybe somebody would give me the lottery numbers or something. One of the discussions.
Scott, I'm sure you have something to say about this.
Actually, I do.
This is my brother, everybody, so say hello to my brother.
Can I input for a minute on this subject?
Sure.
Okay. So For those of you who don't know me, I died helping Ross have lunch one day. I was electrocuted. I was declared brain dead 36 hours later.
Get closer to the mic, bro.
I'm sorry. They unplugged me. I woke up about 8 hours later, and I got better. Now, I have a very distinct memory of a out-of-body experience, of looking down on myself when they were resuscitating me. Now, here's the problem. The accident happened while I was up on a ladder, so I could have a clear memory of what that room looked like from the top. I was a paramedic before I was a respiratory therapist. I'm very familiar with what paramedics do. I work in a hospital. I've resuscitated many people. And I spoke to many people who resuscitated me. So was that really an out-of-body experience? Or was it a well-generated reenactment? There's no way to know. So I don't believe I had an out-of-body experience. I believe I could have easily just put that together based on what I know and what was told to me.
Well, I think what Hugh is saying is really important in that we need to be very skeptical of this kind of thing and eliminate almost all of them. Mm-hmm. But as just being something that went on in the person's head for whatever reason. But there are enough now where people see actual things right. In the real world that they couldn't have seen any other way. I don't know of any other conclusion.
I've told you about the experiment that's going on to prove this, right?
Or where they put little...
There's a very large research project going on where they're putting things in operating rooms that can only be seen from above. Some word like Afghanistan, Bananistan, where if they come back and say, you know, I saw this writing from the top, then they have absolute proof. And I don't know how many hospitals this is going on in, but I know it's in many hospitals. So they are actively researching this. But that's not why I got up here. So here's my question for either one of you. I know this is going to sound like the Buddhist thought. Is it a butterfly dreaming on a man or a man dreaming on a butterfly? Okay. But do you think, Hugh, I've heard you say that this creation is for the elimination of sin, suffering, and evil. Do you think that this is not the sole purpose of God's purpose? Do you think that this is a phase, like a butterfly going through the pupal phase that's breaking out, and this is a step and a longer series of steps that God has to an ultimate creation? Because I know we're going to wipe this all out. Does that question make sense?
Yeah, it does. And you did read me right that I believe that the primary reason God creates the universe is to be a tool in his hand to eliminate all pain, evil, suffering, and death, which is why the universe, from a Christian perspective, is temporary. Once those things have been taken care of, there's no longer a need for the universe. He can usher us into a new realm. And, the last two chapters of the Bible talk about that new realm. What's interesting about that new realm is you see a single sentence in Revelation about God creating kingdoms in the new creation. And just leaves it like that.
Yeah.
Does that mean he's going to create new life forms? I mean, we do know the angels will dwell there. We know redeemed humans will dwell there. But there will be other creatures there. What are those other creatures? We don't know. And what we see in Genesis 1 is that God creates for 6 days. He rests on the seventh day. The new creation we can look at as the eighth day when God creates again.
Yeah.
It's possible that God's got several creation weeks laid out on his calendar. Is the new creation the end of it all? Maybe there's going to be something else that will follow. God seems to enjoy creating. Why would he stop
right.
at just 1 week and maybe an eighth day? There
might
be more.
Do you think we're in the middle of it?
Well, I think it gives all of us some pause. Namely, that our careers, we're told in the new creation, will be to manage that creation, will be magistrates, and will also be judges and rulers and teachers over the angels and over these kingdoms that God creates. And maybe there's a future role that God hasn't told us about that He plans for us human beings. I think what all that tells us is that, you know, we need to take our careers here on earth very seriously, given what it's going to prepare us for in the new creation. And given that God hasn't told us everything, maybe the training we're going through right now has far more significance than we realize. And it's kind of what Paul said in his books, that we need to run this race called life here on planet Earth with every bit of energy we've got. Because as we run the race with all due diligence, it's going to prepare us to be able to serve our Creator more effectively in the new creation and whatever else lies beyond the new creation. But bottom line, the answer to your question is, we don't know. Maybe
possible.
It's possible. God did not close the door. So we will find out. But meantime, let's run the race for all we're worth.
Thank you.
I want to throw Mark a philosophical curveball based on that. I want to say, if you agree with Hugh that the purpose or the main purpose for God creating this universe is to eliminate evil and suffering, couldn't He have done that in the way He created this universe by simply creating a universe in which pain and suffering and evil didn't exist?
Curveball? Is that what you call it? I call it nuclear weapon. Yeah, just tossing a high-yield bomb.
So give us the answer.
Yes.
There you go. Great. Next question. Yeah.
Do we have some questions?
We live in very interesting times. Matthew chapter 24, the signs of Christ's return. Verse 5, for many will come in my name, saying I am the Christ, and will mislead many. False teachers. You will be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. See to it that you are not frightened, for those things must take place, but that is not yet the end. What's going on in Israel, Iran, Iraq, Egypt, Afghanistan, etc. For as nations will rise against nations and kingdom versus kingdoms, and in various places there will be famines and earthquakes. Earthquakes increasingly, natural disasters going on around the world. Japan, Haiti, Christchurch, New Zealand, Peru, Mexico, Italy, etc. You fast forward down to verse 29, and stars will fall from the skies. Last week, meteorite crashed into a rural area about 1,000 miles outside of Moscow, or so I read. At last count, 33,000 miles per hour. The prophet Joel, in Joel 30, corroborates and cross-references the same thing. That was prophecy in the making. And then the Apostle John says in Revelation chapter 6, verse 3, that the stars of from the sky will fall on the earth as a fig tree casts its unripe figs and when shaken by a great wind. Here's my question. The cosmic disturbance of what's going on with the meteor and more to come, that it's speculation that more will... what the Apostle John prophesied, his vision in chapter 6 of Revelation, can that be happening all at the same time, or is that separate time as far as the cosmic disturbance?
Okay. I actually was interviewed about that very question on KKLA last week.
Okay.
And made the point that the Greek word for star that you see there in the text, aster, can mean a star, a planet, a moon, an asteroid, a comet, a meteor. All that's included
right.
With that Greek term that's translated star. So when it talks about stars falling from the sky, that could refer to a meteor shower. And a lot of people thought this event that took place in the Ural Mountains of Russia was kind of a foretending of that very fulfillment of Bible prophecy. The rock that fell in Chelyabinsk, Russia, was about 55 feet in diameter. And it was a stony meteorite, so when it hit the atmosphere at, they now calculate, 46,000 miles per hour, that was enough heat generated by that high velocity to shatter that rock. And so it was basically an air explosion that took place. Didn't kill anybody, but it injured over 1,500 people, mainly from broken glass from the blast of the air explosion. And, how frequently do events like that happen? You get an event like that about once every century. And, for example, back in 1908, there was a similar event that blew down a forest in Siberia. So it looks like Russia's got the last two that we've had. But Russia's the biggest country in terms of land area in the world, so that's not too surprising. Now, the event that took place in Arizona, I don't know how many of you have ever seen the meteor crater in Arizona. The crater is about a mile across in diameter and about 350 feet deep. That was caused by a rock 100 feet in diameter. And you say, how can you get that much energy? Well, it's the energy release is the mass of the object times the velocity squared. And so when you're talking 46,000 miles per hour, even though it's not a very big piece of rock, it generates a lot of energy. The event that took place a few days ago in Russia was estimated to be the explosive equivalent of 30 times the atomic bomb that fell in Hiroshima. Whereas the one that took place in Arizona was several hundred times. Now the reason why that was more damaging, it wasn't a stony meteorite. About 30% of the asteroids that are out there are what we call stainless steel asteroids. They tend not to break up very easily, and they do a lot more damage, and they're more massive. And so that explains why you got such a big crater. Now, fortunately, events like you saw in Winslow, Arizona, that's once every 10,000 years. So these are relatively rare events. On the other hand, a number of JPL scientists have pointed out that we regularly insure ourselves for risks that are much lower than the risk of getting killed by a meteor coming through the Earth's atmosphere. So in that sense, JPL is arguing we need to be monitoring our solar system because, what if something like that were to hit in downtown Manhattan? Then it would do a huge amount of damage. And fortunately, it didn't land on the city of Chelyabinsk. It actually landed on a frozen lake outside of the city and therefore didn't really kill any individuals. It could have been much worse. As far as the prophecy in Revelation concerns, that's a prophecy that we're going to get not just one event like that, but literally hundreds or thousands of events. Has that happened in Earth's history? It certainly has. And so it could happen in the future. Are we monitoring any object that could fulfill the prophecies in Revelation? No. We don't know of any object in the solar system that's going to bring about the imminent fulfillment that we see in the book of Revelation. How much warning can JPL give for such an event? About a year. So, if we're waiting 3 or 4 years, that some kind of thing could happen. In Revelation 8, it actually speaks about a star that will hit one-third of the world's fresh water flowing supply and make it unfit for drinking. And there is a region on the planet where you get one-third of the world's fresh flowing water. And it's a region where that water currently is not being exploited. So if an asteroid were to hit that part of the world, and it was one of these exotic stainless steel asteroids, it could make the water unfit to drink. For example, it could load it up with radioactive cobalt. That could happen. And that water would be unfit to drink. We don't know of any object we're monitoring now that could bring about that fulfillment. But here's another way it could happen. people in NASA are already recognizing the cheapest way to build things in space is not to ship them up from planet Earth, but rather to go out into the asteroid belt and grab one of these stainless steel asteroids, bring it into Earth orbit, and begin to mine it to build equipment in outer space. That's about one-tenth the cost of trying to ship it up from the surface of the Earth. And it's a better grade of stainless steel than our steel companies manufacture. So it seems to make sense. But consider this as a scenario. Some enterprising corporation goes up and grabs one of those asteroids, puts it into Earth orbit, but there's a slight error in the way they adjust it, and it comes crashing into the Earth. So, anyway, next question.
I don't have a question. I just want to make a quick announcement. We record these, and they get on the Internet, and I think it's also appropriate, Ross, that all questions get answered, and your question to Mark about creating a universe without any sin, that a yes answer is a little bit inadequate both for this audience and for our listening audience. And so I would like a little bit more on that. You could obviously talk about the issue of evil and suffering for hours and hours, and Hugh has a wonderful book over here, Beyond the Cosmos, that addresses that. And it's a big problem for a lot of non-believers or even Christians, obviously, the issue of evil and suffering. If there is a good God, why do we have so much evil suffering in the world? And once again, obviously, you know, I'm going to ask for a little capsule answer to that because it's such a critical question. The other part of that, while I have the microphone before I sit down, once again, we have a wonderful book table over here with all the Reasons to Believe books and ladies and helpers to pick the right book for either yourself or a gift for other people. So make sure that you avail yourself of our book table over here. And if you are struggling with the issue of evil and suffering, once again, Hugh's book, Beyond the Cosmos, is a wonderful answer to that question.
Yeah, and I might recommend another book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is, to complement Beyond the Cosmos. That's also over at the book table. And, you know, we make the point there that God, of course, could have created without any sin or evil being possible. But that would mean that we would not be free will beings. And that God created angels, He created human beings, and He created us to be free will beings, which meant that giving us free will, we would have the capacity to express the love that God expresses within the triunity that makes up the Godhead. So long before God created, that God was expressing love. The Holy Spirit was expressing love to the Father and the Son to the Father and the Holy Spirit, and the Father to the Son and the Holy Spirit. But that triune God created, and created with a desire that love would be manifested in His creatures, which meant that God chose to make us human beings free will agents, free to choose to respond to God's love or free to choose to reject God's love. And it's in the rejection of God's love we have the origin of sin and evil. But the amazing thing about the way God structured the physics of the universe is that the physics of the universe has been designed in advance to be tools in God's hands whereby the sin and the evil that we human beings chose can be eliminated once and for all. Now let me give you an analogy, and this is drawn out in more detail in the books, that you know, I've been a professor, and my role as a professor, and Mark here has been a professor, our role as professors is to make our students suffer. We're paid to make our students suffer. Alright, and what's interesting about our students, they want the suffering. They enroll to suffer. That's their purpose for becoming one of our students. They want to suffer at our hand. Now you say, what's the rationality behind that? Well, there's two features. The student knows that the suffering's temporary. The student also understands that that suffering's going to bring about a greater good than if they didn't suffer at all. And so there are careers that you can gain through that suffering, which makes life a whole lot better than if you didn't suffer at all. Well, in Christianity, we have a two-creation model. God creates this universe to be a platform where we suffer for a brief period of time. But through that suffering, we can be delivered permanently from sin and evil, and where our free will that has chosen evil can now be transformed through the laws of physics and the space-time dimensions where we decide we'll never choose evil ever again. But that also explains why in Christianity, nobody gets to experience a new creation without first being tested. Moreover, we're tested by the greatest challenge that evil can perpetrate. So it was no accident that God invited Satan into the Garden of Eden. Satan was the most powerful being that God created. Satan was the one that first rebelled against God. And so Adam and Eve had the opportunity of being subjected to the most difficult tests. Being subjected to the most difficult tests and passing that test through God's help, there is no other test that could possibly threaten them for the rest of eternity. Which is why we can enter into the new creation with our free will intact. Moreover, not just our free will intact, our free will becomes enhanced. It becomes released from the strictures of the laws of physics, where we can express far more love than is possible in this universe, and yet we'll never use that free will to rebel against God ever again. Why? Because we've already been subjected to the most difficult test. We pass that. Nothing ever can threaten us ever again. It can only happen that way if God first exposes us to sin and evil, pain and death. All of those are tools to deliver us permanently from all four of those entities. So just like you willingly signed up to suffer at the hand of your professor, likewise, we're all suffering at the hand of what our Creator has set up and created, but it's for our future benefit. So we can thank God. And this is the message you see in Paul's writings in the New Testament. We can praise God for the suffering, the pain, and the evil we're experiencing, because we know it's going to bring about a greater good.
I have to, Dave called me out and said I had to have an answer more than yes to the question that Ross posed to me. And the question was, could God have used some other method? And the answer is, of course, yes. God isn't limited in his methods to achieve his ends. So if we want to elaborate on this a little bit and understand it a little bit more, the question, the philosophical question could be, if God could do it any other way, and he didn't do it any other way, why did he do it the way he did it? I don't know. Nobody knows. But let's look at some of the implications of the way he did what he did. For example, God had to optimize all of the laws of physics. He had to optimize our spiritual understanding. He had to optimize our mind. He had to optimize everything in order to get the system he has now. In Romans chapter 1, verses 19 through 20, he talks very clearly about the fact that we need to look at the creation in order to understand his invisible attributes and his power and his eternality, which suggests that if God is calling us to look at the design he specifically optimized, that we are to look at that and find out who he is and what he is. In other words, he made it the way he did so that we would look at him in a particular way. Now, in some cases, people say, well, you know, this pain and suffering, why did God make it so much pain and so much suffering? Well, it's to optimize whatever it is that God wants for us. And in some cases, that means that when pain is really, really severe, and as Christians, we're called to go to God with that pain, that means that God has something particularly poignant for us to learn. And other things, too, as well as the other problems of evil where people who aren't Christians are suffering. What is a call for the Christian family to do when other people are suffering? The suffering is very deep. Sometimes it's very, very long term. Sometimes it lasts for a lifetime. What is God telling us about that? He's saying that our obligations are very intense. They're very deep. And that when we act in a way that's shallow, like Hugh said, we need to run the race for all we're worth. We need to run the race for all we're worth when we talk about helping people who are in pain. That's the character of God. And that's what God is explaining to us in the creation. Why he optimized it exactly the way he did. Could a painter do the painting another way? Of course he could. Could God have created the universe in a different way? Of course he could. But he did it this way for a reason, to show us who he is and how he is like. And every feature of the universe calls out to us to appreciate what God is doing with every single aspect of it. That's a philosophical response to that.
Have you all got these cards filled out? Because we like to give away these cash-like prizes. So if we can get these collected, And while we're collecting them, we'll take another question. But right after this question, we're going to give away these books and DVDs.
Before you start, Al, I'd like to chime in on this evil and suffering question. I think for me, I want to be personal here. For me, it's probably the hardest thing. It's the one thing I struggle with the most, being a Christian. Why did God create so much pain and suffering, specifically in my life? I've had plenty of it. And I heard a quote a couple of weeks ago that really floored me. I think it was A.W. Tozer. And he said, God cannot do anything with us until he wounds us first. That quote, I've been thinking about it ever since I heard it. It means that the pain that we feel isn't just part of the universe and sort of happens to us. Sometimes it's God wounding us on purpose. Now, why would he do that? Well, I can speak personally because I can say I've needed that wounding for humility, for slowing down, for acknowledging him in my life, who he is as the creator. I think I would be the cockiest person in the world if it wasn't for a lot of the pain that I have felt. And the hard part for me is to trust him that he's really doing it for my benefit and that I am going to be better for it and have a closer relationship with him. Al.
Years, they may have even been around before the universe was created. And notice that God treats us differently than the angels who disobeyed. The angels who disobeyed have no pathway for redemption. God designed us human beings so we would have a pathway where we could be delivered from our rebellion and our inherent evil, or we wouldn't have any evil at all, and yet we retain our free will. And so that's why it tells us in the new creation we'll be above the angels, even though they're more powerful than we are, because of the fact that we have a different pathway where we can be delivered from a propensity to evil, unlike the angels, then we will be actually elevated to the highest epitome of God's creation. Okay, let's give away this stuff. Do we have all the cards collected? We'll take one more question.
I want to make one comment on what Al had to say. Al, I think in your question there's an implication that God needed a practice session before he got it right. And I think that any being that's powerful enough to create from nothing probably doesn't need a lot of practice. So I would say that there is a perfection in it that we can assume that we may not be able to see and we may not like it, we can't feel it, but I think assuming that it is the best that the best possible way that it could be done is the way he did it is a safer, more rational assumption.
And it's testable. By making more measurements of the universe, we can see whether we see increasing evidence for optimization or decreasing evidence. And you can read about that in The Creator and the Cosmos. Okay. Next.
All right, so the end of times, John, the prophet, he was on the island of Patmos. Is that what it was called?
Right.
And he writes a revelation in the times that, and you've said that there'd be a 1,000-year reign with Jesus on TV and stuff, so you can't get away from him. And then after that, he would release the demon from his cage or whatever, and then people still had a choice. They would either follow Jesus 1,000 years that they've gotten used to him, or go to the devil. Is that basically how it is at the end of times?
Okay. First of all, not all Christians take a premillennial perspective on end times. I happen to believe that there will be a 1,000-year reign of the Creator of the universe here on planet Earth. And I believe that Isaiah kind of puts it in the context that what God does during that 1,000 years is take away all of our human excuses for why we rebel and why we express evil to our fellow human beings. He basically says, okay, you think it was bad government? I'm going to set up a perfect government here on planet Earth. You claim that you didn't see God? Hey, you'll be able to see me anytime you want on television. Or are you going to claim that it was the police force or it was a bad economy, it was poverty? I'm going to remove all poverty. During the millennium, God removes every human excuse for why we sin, except the real reason. The real reason is expressed in Jeremiah 17, 9 and 10. The reason why we sin, the reason why we express evil to our fellow human beings, is because our human hearts are in a state of rebellion against God. That's the one and only reason. And how God proves that during the millennium, He takes away all excuses, even locks up Satan. Because a lot of people say, well, the reason why I did those nasty things, the devil made me do it. Okay, He's going to lock the devil up. You can't use that as an excuse. But what does He do at the end of the millennium? He releases Satan from his prisoner to test all the children that are born during the millennium. Based on the principle, nobody gets to go to the new creation unless they're tested. You have to take a test. Just like nobody gets through the courses that I teach unless they take a test. The test is crucial. No test, no grade. Same thing with God's system. And what it tells us is that even though that these children, quote, had all the advantages, where every excuse was removed, even then, the majority of the children will be sucked in by the deception of Satan and choose to rebel. So...
Okay, that was the assertion. I just want to make sure you, because I haven't asked the question yet. That was...
Oh, I'm sorry.
No. I wanted to make sure that I was correct in what I was saying, and you... I just got about to. Oh, hi. So, so the question is, if that's true, what happens if tomorrow we nuke each other to death and there's not one human being left on this planet tomorrow? Because that's the possibility. Then what happens to that story?
Well, if we wind up nuking every human being to death tomorrow, then yeah, that would be damaging to what John has prophesied in the book of Revelation. But I happen to believe, based on sound evidence, that all the prophecies in the Bible are fulfilled without error and without exception. So on that basis, I'm persuaded that tomorrow there will not be an all-out nuclear war that will wipe out every human being. Now, having said that, if you were to read Ezekiel 39, it does talk about God raining down fire on the people of Tarshish that dwell in safety in the distant coastlands. And there are Bible interpreters who look at that as a prediction that people living here in North America will experience nuclear war. However, it won't wipe out every human being. And that's one interpretation. There are other people who interpret that passage differently.
All right, let's give away some stuff. All of you who filled out cards. Oh, wow, it's me. No, I'm kidding. Ted Arkellian.
What's he going to get?
And what do you get? I don't even know what we're giving away. I'm just calling the names. Okay. How about you take your choice, Ted? Which one do you want? We've got a DVD called The Great Debate between Hugh and Victor Stinger and Scientific Breakthroughs of 2012 or Why the Universe is the Way It Is. All right, you've got it. Lee Rising. Where are you, Lee? There we are. Congratulations. Which one would you like, Lee? Mark, you want to pick the last one?
Okay. Carol Geaton?
Geaton.
Geaton?
Well, you want us to draw another name? Okay, very good.
Very good.
Thank you, everyone. That's right. Next question.
Oh, great. Thank you. With respect to the person who went before, I just want to say it's probably pretty easy to wipe out 80% of us in a nuclear war, but statistically, getting that last 5 or 10% of us is probably going to be really, really hard, right? So we'll survive, at least a few. Praise the Lord. Little joke, anyway. Professor Ross,
In the skeptical realm, you hear two main arguments to cosmological creation these days. I think they're sort of the last refuge of scoundrels, but anyway, multiverses and a quantum fluctuation as the two things. And I wanted to ask what your best, most crushing argument is to those two. With respect to multiverses, I always say to them, well, you can never go to the other multiverse, make a measurement, and come back, or you can never send a photon there and send a photon back, right? That's my argument to them on that. And then on quantum fluctuations, you make some good arguments in Creator and Cosmos. But I just wanted to ask what your two most crushing arguments would be to wipe those out.
Yeah, in terms of the quantum fluctuation, I've written most extensively about that in the Creator and the Cosmos. And for the multiverse, in my book, More Than a Theory. And if I had to pick one for each, for the quantum fluctuation, I would make the point that every quantum event requires time. And the less time you have, the less probability that the event will take place. And if you got no time at all, the probability is zero. Well, we already have in the space-time theorems proof that the beginning of the universe is the beginning of time. So in that context, you can't explain the creation of the universe from some kind of quantum event because you would need time to make that happen. And people like Stephen Hawking acknowledge that, which is why he speculates that maybe there is another dimension of time associated with the universe. But he also admits in his writings that every experiment we do in physics establishes that indeed the universe is constrained to a single dimension of time that can't be stopped or reversed. Therefore, the quantum fluctuation idea really doesn't fly. Now, for the multiverse, I could think of 8 good arguments why that's not a good argument to explain away the need for a personal creator. But probably the one I would focus on first would be that the argument is self-defeating. In the sense that you're going to claim that an infinite number of universes manifesting an infinite variety of all the characteristics of the laws of physics and the characteristics of the universe, so that all this fine-tuning that we measure is simply there by pure chance. You could also make the point, well, that same kind of multiverse would actually predict that you would get an infinite number of planets exactly like planet Earth. And on those infinite number of planet Earths, you'd have an infinite number of beaches. And those infinite number of beaches, you had an infinite number of random markings in the sand, where one of those infinite number of random markings in the sand would be identical to all the characters that make up a research paper published by Lawrence Krauss. Therefore, those papers published by Lawrence Krauss are not the product of intelligent agency, rather than the product of pure chance. And so, you know, no physicist thinks that way. Therefore, the argument in that sense is self-defeating.
Regarding exoplanets, as you know, Kepler, I think, has probably in the realm of 800 and something now, or is it 700 and something, planets discovered outside our solar system. And so far, we have not found a planet anywhere near the twin of Earth. But going beyond that to the sun, like you pointed out sometimes in the past, that we should look for a solar twin first. And then when you find a solar twin, then you could look around that solar twin to see if there's an Earth-like planet. And how much of a solar twin do you have to make that next step? In other words, how close do you have to be to our sun to say, okay, there's a solar twin? And how many suns have we looked at so far and have not found that solar twin?
Well, you're right that in terms of trying to save the taxpayer money, if your goal is to find a planet like Earth that can sustain life, let's first see if we can find another star like the sun. Because we know the sun has to have extremely fine-tuned characteristics in order for there to be a possibility of a planet orbiting that just right star. Where life would be possible. And the advantage there is that stars are a lot easier to measure than planets. I mean, you need really expensive and sophisticated technology to detect these planets, but stars a lot easier. And you're right. We've discovered 864 planets outside of our solar system, but we know of hundreds of billions of stars in our own galaxy, let alone the other galaxies. However, of those hundreds of billions of stars in our galaxy, there's only a few million that we can measure with sufficient precision to see if they're a close enough twin to the Sun to be a candidate where advanced life could exist on a planet orbiting that star. Now, this search began 50 years ago. So like planets, we've only known them since 1995 outside of our solar system. But the quest to find a solar twin has been seriously undertaken for more than 50 years. And all the research tells us there is no solar twin. Of the several million stars that we checked out so far, none of them come in as a solar twin. They have found solar analogs. A solar analog is a star that approximately has the same mass as the Sun and the same age as the Sun. But if you want a candidate for advanced life, it would have to have virtually the identical mass of the Sun. Not close, but it's got to be identical. The age has to be identical. It's got to be identical to within a million years and probably within 100,000 years. And then it has to have the same chemical composition as the Sun. And in particular, the thing that really rules out the solar twins, it has to have the same lithium abundance. The Sun has an anomalous abundance of lithium, and because of that anomalous abundance of lithium, it has a very low level of flaring activity. And one reason why it has to be virtually the same age is only when the Sun is perfectly middle-aged do you have that minimum flaring. So there's a reason why God put human beings on planet Earth when the Sun was 4.57 billion years old. Because there's a window of time about 100,000 years wide where the Sun has this minimum flaring activity and extremely stable luminosity coming out from the Sun. And so how many years do we have left? Probably no more than 40,000 years before we exit that very stable period of solar luminosity. So yeah, I mean, you can look on our website. I've written several articles on the search for solar twins, but as it now stands, there is no twin of the Sun. What is interesting is they have found stars that are twins of one another, but the Sun has no twin, at least no twin we've discovered yet.
Mm-hmm. Is it about 200 finely tuned parameters that you need to get a solar twin? They have to be tuned just right?
Yeah, I don't think it's quite that high. I mean, we know of about 50 different characteristics of the Sun that must be fine-tuned for that star to be a candidate. And, you know, the fact that we've only been able to measure, a 5 to 10 million stars to see if they're solar twins, actually is pretty close to the total level of stars in our Milky Way galaxy. Because one of the requirements for life is that the star be orbiting the center of the galaxy just inside the co-rotation distance. So if it's towards the center of our galaxy, it's not a candidate. If it's towards the halo of our galaxy, it's not a candidate. It literally has to be sharing the same orbit about the center of the galaxy the Sun does, which means we don't have to examine all the stars of our galaxy. We already know that 99.9% of the stars in our galaxy are non-candidates without measuring their spectral characteristics.
So the bottom line is, Hugh, that what you're saying is that there are so many characteristics that need to be exactly tuned perfectly for life to exist on this planet that even with all the 50 billion trillion stars that exist, it couldn't have happened by chance.
That's true, because we also realize that there's no twin to the Milky Way galaxy. You might say, what about all the stars, trillions of stars in other galaxies? We can't find an adequate twin of our Milky Way galaxy. And so, and in terms of a galaxy, there's about 200 characteristics that have to be fine-tuned to make it a candidate. So yeah, when our family celebrates Thanksgiving, we thank God for the fact that we live in a galaxy with highly symmetrical spiral arms that have not been disturbed by any merger events in the last 9.5 billion years. You know, Thanksgiving's kind of interesting at our household. My sons always wish I would shut up, but let's get on with the food.
Warren.
Doesn't the multiverse greatly complicate the hypothesis of self-creation rather than answer it?
Well, the multiverse does not really get around the need for a transcendent causal agent. All multiverse models, those proposed by atheists and those proposed by Christians, and by the way, there are Christian multiverse models that are valid. My colleague Jeff Zwirink, another astronomer on our staff, has written a booklet where he makes the point that the multiverse is only consistent from a Christian perspective. The atheistic models lead to contradictions, such as the one example that I did give. But the atheists proposing these multiverse models do admit that they're all subject to the space-time theorems. They're not designed to eliminate the need for God. They're designed to eliminate the need for a personal God. That's really the goal of these people that are proposing these multiverse models. They're okay with God setting up the laws of physics, creating the universe. They're just not that happy with a God that actually observes the affairs of human beings and judges and evaluates them. And so that's really the whole purpose of some of these multiverse speculations. But yeah, the person who first came to the microphone on this made the point that the multiverse from an atheistic perspective cannot be proven. Because as Einstein pointed out, once you've got universes that have observers in them, those universes are sufficiently separated that the space-time manifold of universe A will never overlap the space-time manifold of any other possibly existing universe. Which means if you're an observer in this universe, you can never, through your measurements, prove the existence of any other existing universe. Which is why many philosophers have pointed out these multiverse models are not testable. But that's a bit of an overstatement. There are ways you can disprove them. There are no ways to prove them. But yeah, there are ways you can disprove the multiverse model. So for example, certain values of the geometry of our universe would eliminate the multiverse hypothesis by direct measurement. But we don't know the geometry of the universe with sufficient precision at this particular date.
Mark, what are the philosophical implications of a scientific theory that has no data and can't ever have data?
The real problem, yeah. And the biggest problem is if you have no way of proving something, at least in principle, then you're talking metaphysics. And that's really what you are at when you look at the multiverse problem. The multiverse problem is a metaphysical problem. And if you can't access it, even in principle, by some kind of empirical test, you're speculating, and that's all you're doing.
So it's not science.
It's not science in the sense that you can test it. So you're right. It's speculation and it's metaphysics and it's interesting, but that's about it.
Next question.
This is an atheist question. Why this all-power God controls all things, preordained, select all things? Want to have fun, to have evil and good fighting and so many lives got in the between died. So what do you think about this?
Well, God could intervene from the laws of physics and rescue every human being from disease, disasters, wars. He can do that. And as we see recorded in the Bible, that has happened on occasion, but it's rare. The reason why it's rare is that God designed the laws of physics to be tools to restrain the expression of evil. And if he were to rescue human beings from every time the second law of thermodynamics brings pain into your life or suffering into your life or some kind of a disastrous event, that would mitigate the benefit of the laws of physics to be a tool in God's hand to encourage the expression of virtue by free will beings and to restrain the expression of evil. And so the only time that God does intervene is when the intervention will actually bring about a greater deliverance from evil than simply letting the laws of physics run their course.
So it happens rarely and will always only happen rarely because there's real value in being subjected to gravity, electromagnetism, and thermodynamics, even though those laws of physics are causing your body to decay, causing your chin to sag as you get older and older, your hair to get grayer and grayer, and causes your body to experience more and more discomfort as you age. Bottom line is that's all for your benefit. And so that's another thing we thank God for when we celebrate Thanksgiving, is the rotten decay that takes place in our physical bodies as a result of the second law of thermodynamics.
You can thank him for that if you want. Yeah. I think the question, though, Hugh, was your question more about free will and predestination?
Actually, it's atheist try to argue that we don't have a chance if God has all power. So where's the fair battle here? Since he's the creator, he pre-selected who is going to be in, who is not. So he said, if you want to play a game, there's no fair rule here. That's what the question is about.
No, that's a good point. I mean, the Bible does tell us that God's in control of everything. If he is in control of everything, then where is there free will? You know, why are we being held in judgment by God? But the problem there is the skeptic is trying to resolve human free will and divine predetermination, where God controls every word you speak, every thought you think, every action you perform from before he created the universe. The skeptic is trying to resolve that issue, or claiming it can't be resolved, in the context of the dimensions we human beings can visualize, length, width, height, and time. But God is not constrained by length, width, height, and time. And that's something you'll see in our book, Beyond the Cosmos, that if we simply allow God the freedom to operate in the equivalent of three dimensions of time rather than one dimension of time, there's multiple possible solutions to the problem of divine predetermination and human free will. I give you three in the book, and all three could be wrong. I'm simply showing you that they're possible solutions. And if they're possible solutions, then we've answered the skeptic's charge that Christianity is self-contradictory. It's only self-contradictory if we constrain God to just four dimensions.
Bottom line is, God knew how everything was going to play out, every thought that we have, every molecular motion, before he created anything. It was predestined. That's true. The Bible teaches it. Equally true, we make our own free choices to follow God, to not follow God. We really do have an honest, sincere free will. And how you can put those two together, like Hugh says, we can't do that given the way we can look at the world. But they're both true. The Bible seems to teach both of those.
Eight times in the Bible, it teaches you both in the same sentence. And, you know, these Bible writers weren't stupid. They knew what they were doing.
We are out of time. Al, sorry. You can come tomorrow. I would like to ask, I want to say thank you, Hugh, very much, Mark. And I would like to ask you to close us in prayer.
I'd be happy to do that. Thank you. Lord, you gave us a world that we're to interrogate in order to find out who you are and what you are. And we bless you that throughout these years, you've continued to make it more responsive to our inquiries so that we can find out more about you. I pray for everybody in this room that as we go about our lives in the next few weeks and months and years, we'll spend more time looking for you, honoring you, and learning how we can be faithful to you. And we ask also that those who have come looking for answers would find those answers in you, and that whatever depth it is that you're struggling them through, Lord, that it would ultimately lead them to you and to the right way. And we bless you and give you all the honor in Christ's name. Amen.
Thank you, everyone. And I want to remind you, we're going to do this again tomorrow night at 7 o'clock right next door. So thank you, everybody, for coming.